he had an answering machine, and I let it ring, and a woman said, yes, hello, this is Kate Bush for Future Heads.
What?
I wanted to say that I really liked Hounds of Love, and I'm like,
oh!
Hi, I'm Lawrence Diamond.
And I'm Bob Matthews.
And this is The Process of Production.
All right, mate, how's 2023 going for you?
Yeah, 2023 is going good. Wow, so yeah, the last episode we did was our Black Friday episode. Christmas comes, New Year comes.
Yeah.
While that was going on, it might have seemed like we were off on holiday, you know, drinking eggnog and, you know, doing après-ski stuff. But yeah, we were gathering interviews like squirrels gathering nuts in winter.
Well, we did hope to have some new episodes for you by Christmas, but when, you know, with Christmas looming, we thought let's put all our focus into launching big time next year, get some big hitter guests and, you know, come back with a bang.
Yes, that's true. And the guest we've got this week is actually someone that we wanted from day one of the podcast.
Exactly.
Catherine Marks, or CJ Marks, produces The Big Moon, The Amazons, Frank Carter and The Rattlesnakes, early Wolf Alice stuff. And she actually came up engineering The Killers and Foals with Flood and Anna Mulder. So she's a big name on the production circuit already, but I think she's going to be producing some of like the seminal albums of our time in the coming years. And that's such a dick sentence to say, or such a dick way to say that sentence, seminal albums. Mm. But like, I really feel like her work's at the cutting edge of alternative or rock at the moment. And I think it's true.
She's also now heading up the Music Producers Guild here in the UK. So, you know, she's a pretty big wheel in the industry, as well as being like a, you know, very talented creative. So, you know, ambitious and powerful human being. And it's a pleasure to have her on the pod.
What I found quite interesting about it is she came up with Alan Moulder and Flood, who, if you don't know, are two kind of leviathans of 90s and early noughties rock and production.
What a word. Yeah, let's just run through some of the acts that those guys have worked on. So U2, Nine Inch Nails, Depeche Mode, PJ Harvey, Interpol, Sigur Rós. More recently, like, I think Mulder's worked on the Wet Leg album that just won a Grammy.
Lovely stuff.
You know, and they kind of come as a package, right? Or do they just work a lot together? Like, what's,
they work what, a lot together, and yeah. I think Assault and Battery, where Catherine came up and interned in and engineered at and was sort of in-house engineer at, that's, I believe, is their shared studio space. I may be getting that wrong, but it's certainly a place they both work a lot. So they have that relationship, and Catherine's sort of, the origin story of Catherine's career is really interesting, and we allude to it in the interview, but basically she was an architecture student from Australia doing a year out in Dublin, and she met Flood at a Nick Cave concert, and basically just, I think, as she's admitted, didn't really quite know what a big deal he was, but said, oh, you're a music producer, I'd quite like to do that.
Yeah.
And he was like, well, okay, go home, go back to Australia, finish your degree, because if you come back to London and decide to be a record producer, you'll never see daylight again. And she says that she, you know, she very happily went and did that and came back, and he wasn't lying. She didn't see daylight for 15 years, but she absolutely loved it. And she's got some great stories from that time, including working with Kanye West, and we get the story on that.
Yeah.
So it's actually, considering she's worked with all these big names and has this like amazing background, I found it was quite a technical chat. It was almost one for the heads.
She got some good technical tips, and like, actually really went in on the detail on some compression stuff and some great like proper techie tips.
Yeah, no, it's a really good interview. Before we get going, we started our last series with I awfully sung some Aaliyah lyrics from Try Again.
Oh yeah.
And I've just thought, I've got top five songs about being back.
Oh nice, that's great.
So Try Again, Aaliyah, number one.
Great.
Back in Black, Amy Winehouse.
Lovely.
Big tune. Mm-hmm. Without Me by Eminem.
Amazing.
If I was going to be truly embarrassing, I would have started this series with Look Who's Back Again from Without Me by Eminem.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Boys Are Back in Town.
I was going to say Thin Lizzy's got to be in there, yeah.
Indisputable classic.
Yeah.
And this is an absolute niche deep cut, that only like indie boys from the mid-noughties would be into. But
I'm here.
Shout Out Louds.
Oh,
had a song called The Comeback.
That's even a bit deep for me. I don't remember
that. And I feel that that's sort of referencing Don't Call It a Comeback, I Never Went Away.
Okay.
In like a really, in a really lame, like indie, Swedish indie way. And that's, sorry, one second. Is that Coolio? Don't call it a comeback. I never went away.
I don't know that.
LL
either.
Cool J. Don't call it a comeback. Yeah, I never went away. Yeah. So
that's nice. Nice that you bring up Aaliyah. I just had an artist referencing "Are You That Somebody?" as which is, you know, anytime an artist references Aaliyah or any of Timbaland's work, I'm like, yes, you know, you're talking my language. Let's go.
Absolutely.
Have we got any more updates for everyone out there, or should we just dive straight into the interview?
I think we should just say it's an absolute pleasure to be back. We've got episodes locked and loaded for the coming months. We've got some really great producers that we can't wait to bring you these episodes for. A few of you have been reaching out on the email saying, where are you?
Yeah.
We've been really enjoying it. We want you to be back. So thank you so much to those people who have been. We are
really
back.
Really appreciate the people who've stuck with us and still been giving us listens in this downtime. It does mean a lot that, you know, the pod's out there and it's people are still going back and listening to the old episodes. It's wicked.
Yeah, and this is definitely one that we've wanted to bring you for a long time. So thank you to Catherine and to her management for facilitating it. And I think you'll get a lot from it. Shall we do it?
Yeah, here we go.
Catherine Marks is an Australian producer and mixer based in London, England. She began her career after a chance meeting with super producer Flood at a Nick Cave concert in the early 2000s. Abandoning a career in architecture, she moved to London full-time to assist at his legendary Assault and Battery Studios in Willesden. Engineering work on albums by artists such as PJ Harvey, Foles and Interpol followed. Despite initially following a career solely in mixing, her work on Wolf Alice's Creature Songs EP led her to take the producer's chair on albums by some of the 21st century's most exciting rock and alternative acts, including The Amazons, The Big Moon, The Mysterines, Manchester Orchestra, and The Wombats. She also recently worked on Alanis Morissette's 2020 comeback album, Such Pretty Forks in the Road. In 2018, she was voted the Music Producer Guild's Producer of the Year. She also recently moved to her own new studio space in Kensal Town, and this is where she dialed in to talk to us.
So what brought on the move? Are we right in saying that you were working out of Battery until recently?
Yes, I was. Okay. I was working out of Assault and Battery, and I moved last August. So I would work a lot in Assault and Battery too, record loads of albums up there, and then I had a little mix room downstairs, which used to be an old mastering suite, which was the size of this kitchen table, maybe like double the size. Right.
Okay.
So it was really small, but it was, I knew exactly how everything sounded in there, so I could like do something upstairs and run down and like check it. But I'd basically been at Battery since I first moved to London in 2005. I mean, obviously, wow. I worked in loads of other places,
sure,
but that had kind of been my home for so long, and it just felt like I wanted to change and sort of put on my big boy pants and
yeah,
bigger studio that I could do overdubs in, and you know, it's been. A lot of writers now use it as a room when I'm not, as a writing room when I'm not in here, just because it's such a, there's like natural lights on the ground floor. Yeah, it's great. I mean, it's not perfectly soundproof, but again, I don't care about that stuff. It actually reminds me of years ago, again, when I first started Flood, before Flood and Alan got Assault Battery 2. So they had the mix room at Assault Battery, which is A and B 1. Flood had a room. It was called, we called it the bedroom, but it was in an old converted dairy on Kilburn Lane in West London. It was, there were lots of other studios. Mark Ralph had a room there.
Yep.
Jimmy Hoyogarth had a room. Cameron Craig had a room there, apparently. He said we met and I just had no recollection.
I know that studio. I worked with Mark Ralph in that studio. Yes.
But ours, if you walked into that courtyard, my studio was on the right, and it was like a big kind of barn space. We did loads of records in there, but one PJ Harvey White Chalk in there. And this space kind of reminds me of that because it's all open. There's no sound separation. I can't wait to have some drums in the corner over, you know, even if it's like a small kit. Yeah, I like that kind of expansive atmosphere that a bigger room gives you.
And when you're working with bands, do you enjoy that sort of interaction you can get? Like, I know with the Big Moon record, you made sure that everyone was in the room sort of playing together. And I'm assuming maybe PJ Harvey works a bit like that. It's not like anodyne, like put the drum in there and isolate it, put the bass player there and isolate it. So is it that kind of, to get that feel that you get in that music that you tend to work with, that kind of interaction?
I mean, the Big Moon we did at Eastcote, so there's separation between the control room and the live room. But I think having everyone in the same room, it makes communication a lot quicker and more efficient. Yeah. There is something nicer about that than rather than pressing a button and, you know, talking down the talk back, and they're like, "I can't hear you. I can't hear you." And you're like, "Oh, yeah.
I'll come through. I'll come through." Yeah,
exactly. So yeah, I think that. I mean, I wouldn't say that this room is big enough to do like track a live band, but never say never.
You seem to kind of have quite an interesting role and interesting path where you've straddled production and mixing. Is that because you tend to do both? How do you see your role? And
I think, I mean, at the moment I'm mixing a record that I didn't produce, and I love that because I have no kind of necessarily emotional attachment to it, particular parts. So I feel like I feel like a lot freer, and I can make bigger, bolder moves without clinging to something that I've been living with for a long time. Whereas when I mix what I've produced, I like inch everything. I feel really bound by something that I already had in my head that already sounds like that, you know. Mm. It takes me much longer to kind of get it to where it should be.
Well, it's tough, isn't it? Because, sorry to interrupt, but I've read an interview where you said you're making mixed decisions even as you track and stuff. So it must be harder to then... I understand what you're saying about making incremental moves from that point forward, because you've presumably gotten quite close to what you wanted, and so now you're seeing the minutiae.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, of course, the kind of crippling self-doubt of could someone do, you know, make it better. I mean, I remember on the Amazons record, first album we did together, I don't think I touched any of the drums in the mixing.
Really?
Wow. Everything was just about balance, because they sounded so great when we tracked them. I might have added in like a few samples just for EQ to kind of add brightness, because I love like a really deep snare, just tweaked EQs and stuff, but not a lot. And on a lot of the Manchester Orchestra records we do, I barely touch the guitars because we've picked certain tones to fit the kind of frequencies that we want. Mm. Again, like maybe sort of tiny little tweaks, but everything sort of sits the way we want it to sit. Mm-hmm. But I think the reason I do mixing at all is because before I got into production properly, I assisted Alan and was engineering for Alan mixing. So I was kind of learning mixing. Yeah. He really got me to focus in on that discipline and sort of imagine myself going to be a mixer.
Right.
You know, so forget about all the other stuff. Forget about writing. Yeah. Forget about, you know, trying to do everything. Just really hone this skill. Mm. And I think it's made me a much better producer for it, but I still really enjoy mixing. I love mixing other people's projects because there's something so fun about it. Whereas when I mix my own projects, it's pain and suffering.
I suppose as well, you're like, you're doing the mix of something you've done and there's like a guitar part that's not working. And you're like, yes, but me and the artist spent like a day and a half and I rented that pedal and it cost a third of their budget and we have to use this. Whereas if you just get that stem, you're like, oh, that guitar doesn't sound good. I'll pull that down. And if it makes the song better, it makes the song better. And you haven't kind of got that emotional interaction with it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Did, because a lot of the producers we speak to, it feels like they come to, it's interesting you've said that about that path, because it tends to be producers have been producing for a while and then their manager or the label starts going, oh, well, can you not just mix it for us? Yeah. Whereas it's unusual that you mix first and come to production. It's sort of a reverse pathway. And I know that you did a lot of engineering for Flood and Alan before, but did that sort of influence how you produce? Have you still sort of got those little engineer hats and the mixing hats on when you go to make these records?
Yeah, I think definitely. I mean, obviously, I'm kind of building them, as like you said, I'm building this as I go. But also, it gave me an understanding of how something is finished, because I think prior to working with Alan, I'd be part, you know, I'd be engineering or assisting, I'd be part of the production process, but I didn't know what happened after that. You know, in my head, I'm like, oh, I can do anything, and someone else will make it better. Whereas I was working on with Alan what you get at the end. And, you know, also there's also like professional courtesy as well, you know, wanting to deliver something to someone that means that they don't have to work too hard. Mm,
right.
There was that aspect, and then also the attention to detail.
Right.
So Well, thing I suppose like detail things. They might be, say, there's a guitar part, and there's sort of like a cool little lick or something that occurs throughout like a whole take. It might be that I then get the artist to kind of double that. You know, we use like an interesting sound to kind of enhance that little moment, so that it's not just about a ride. It sort of makes that little moment a bit more interesting. I think that's what I mean about the attention to detail. It's like creating kind of these little interesting moments, whether it's, you know, it could even just be like a transition between a verse and a chorus or something like that, where you know, you get the sense of something kind of building, and use that through what we've recorded rather, again, than just using automation. You know, what can we find that kind of gives that sensation of something kind of about to lift and arrive, you know, without using a reverse cymbal?
Yeah, sure. Right. Yeah. Without going to their sample back going, that's a good one. That'll do. Yeah. That usually does it.
Yeah, exactly.
We don't get to speak to a lot of producers who I suppose get the benefit now to spend time in pre-production. But with the work you do, and I know you've spoke about it a lot, about it being such a crucial part of making a record, and I guess also building a relationship with the people you're about to make a record with. Could you talk to us a little bit about that approach, both kind of what you're looking to do with the songs and the sounds, and also how you're building this relationship with what can often be four or five egos that you then sort of have to manage over quite a bit of time?
Yeah, I mean, pre-production is so useful. One, it reduces the budget, the amount of time, you know, the potential kind of mistakes that you might be making in the studio.
Sure.
It's 90% us getting to hang out and getting to know each other, and me getting to understand how they work together, so that then I'm able to kind of plan ahead, you know, who needs sort of this kind of attention, what do we need to do with this particular part, how do they play against each other. Also encouraging them to listen to each other as well, to kind of work off each other and then edit themselves and adjust their parts perhaps. So often, but also the pre-production allows us to kind of experiment and break down the songs and then build them up again. Often I start with the drums. You know, it might be something like making sure that the drum groove is supportive of the vocal metering or something like that, you know, making sure those kind of things groove together. Or, you know, a guitar strum, if there's two guitarists, are they strumming the same thing? Does that make it feel stronger? Or does it make it feel stronger if they're playing off each other?
Yeah.
Just those sort of kinds of details.
Does this usually take place in a rehearsal context, or is it just hanging out listening to demos?
In a rehearsal space. So everyone's got their instruments set up. I'm usually sitting on the floor. I've got my voice memo on. Mm-hmm. You know, we'll try sort of transition things or drum groove shifts, and I'll just record everything so we've just got a reference. Mm-hmm. And then also, because we sort of feel so comfortable together, it then makes the transition going into the studio feel like an extension of that.
Yeah.
It's not, okay, day one, set up instruments. This is what is going to happen now. Press record.
Yeah.
Everyone has sort of got the ideas in their head, and I let Pro Tools run. Mm-hmm. And we just start playing, but it's just still rehearsing, still kind of dialing in sounds. Nothing is it until it's it, if that makes sense.
Great. Yeah. Your kind of biography's been dealt with quite comprehensively in some of the other interviews you've done, so we don't want to like retread old ground too much, but you famously met Flood at a Nick Cave gig back in the early noughties, is that correct? And that's cool. And
I love that story.
It's a great story, yeah.
But then I thought maybe we could pinpoint the moment where you sort of you felt comfortable to step out of the role of protege and start doing your own jobs. Like, what can you pinpoint, an album or a moment in your career where you felt that shift, or maybe it was a slower transition?
I don't really know when that defining moment was. I think probably on the Folds record, when I worked for both Flood and Alan. And I mean, I say this a lot, but I think there was other people who were far superior and way better qualified to do it than me, but I just bugged them the most to be able to engineer that record. And I remember those first 2 weeks, obviously because they're both such amazing engineers themselves, I kind of felt like I was still in like a bit of an assisting role. And then after 2 weeks, I was just like, I could see the amount of work that they were doing. I was like, guys, I've got it. leave right. it with.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I don't know what happened, but I just suddenly felt like, oh, I can do this. I know what I'm doing. I've been doing this a lot. It doesn't make any difference that it's them, and I can help. You know, this is what I'm here to do. So rather than like me stepping back and not wanting to step on anyone's toes, it's like my job actually is to make their lives easier. And it was a massive setup and a massive challenge, but it was, you know, the best, you know, course being thrown in the deep end is the best learning curve ever.
Yeah.
And it proved very successful. But also, you know, they had my back too. You know, Alan and I often be in the control room together and we'd be dialing in sounds or whatever. Actually, I remember there was on the Trident, we were dialing in a snare and I was like, I boosted 3K to about 10 dB, I think, whatever the maximum you could go. And we were like, oh, that sounds good. And then like the take goes through and I turn around, I was like, it's in bypass.
Yes.
Because I was like, oh, it feels so good to feel brave. Yeah. Let's just crank this guy up.
That makes me feel good because that's the kind of thing I'm always doing. I'm like, oh, wow, this plugin is just doing exactly what I'd hoped it would do. And Bob be like, yeah, I think it's on a different channel and you're soloing it. And I'm like, oh okay, I'll just...
the old DFA knob.
Yeah.
I suppose there's like, it must be hard in that moment because as you say, you're there with two like engineers, two producers, but with their engineering thing and you're... I suppose you're starting to make decisions, so it's like that's set up and ready for them to go. And we all suffer from imposter syndrome to a certain extent. But I suppose you just have to go like, I can't have that anymore. I've just got to get this ready for them to go. And if they hate it and be like, why did you choose this preamp, Catherine, you idiot? I'll just have to deal with that at this point. And
the thing was, they really empowered me, so I never felt like undermined, and nor was I undermining them. I mean, look, this is obviously looking back with rose-coloured glasses. I'm sure someone raised their voice at some point.
Sure.
But I don't think it was ever at me, thankfully. and also working with the Foles boys, they were, you know, it was so fun and interesting and exciting what they were trying to do. Mm. So I felt inspired to kind of create a situation that made it easier for them to kind of plug in and play and press record. Mm. You know, the way we had a lot of the things set up, kind of everything was ready to go, whether it was like a synth station or a pedal station, or all the guitar amps were mic'd up. I mean, there was pretty much every, you know, you couldn't bitch about anyone because all the mics were
always being agreed.
Corner.
Yeah.
Not only that, there was GoPros sort of randomly around the studio as well. Oh my God, I remember I remember there was someone had put a mini cam or handy cam, whatever they're called, you know, those old sort of like VHS, just in front of like on the console in the control room. And we were recording My Number and we'd recorded that so many times in order to get right, like on various different days. And they did a take. And I remember looking, Al goes, what do you think? And I remember looking at him going, could have been a f***ing disaster. Then you just see me see the camera. Yanis comes back in behind us from playing, walks in with a can of Coke, drops it. Someone else comes in, falls over the can of Coke. I mean, it's just like this sort of weird comedy of errors. And a lot of that was caught on camera.
Captured for posterity.
Yeah. There was also, I didn't know if there was like a GoPro, because we had another kind of B room set up and there was a GoPro sitting above the computer screen and I was just totally ignored it. But there's basically a day just sped up of me doing this, head in my hands repeatedly, like just this really fast.
Is that you in despair or is that your listening at? Face?
I don't know. It's just funny. It's just like obviously struggling with something.
Yeah. I read something interesting about that album session in your Sound on Sound interview, where you talk about like putting loads of different drum mics up, like room mics, and having them run through different compressors and stuff. That sounds like fun. And like, how do you then like cycle through all the options? Because there is something I recognize as the tyranny of choice. Like when you have so many options, it's a bit like, I don't know what to do. Like, how do you make those decisions?
Well, I still do this so often, and again, it's just for efficiency rather than like for choice.
Right.
So set a bunch of room mics up. Obviously, you kind of mic the kit, bunch of room mics, and it's just so you can move, you know, depending on what the kind of the track is, I can then move them around. You know, I literally just go into the room and go, okay, this feels good here, and I'll just, it's just so I can move it rather than telling someone to, you know, plug something in.
Sure.
And then once you kind of have all the tracks set up and the, you know, the drummer is working through stuff, I'll just mute a bunch of things. So, and then that's the choice made at the beginning.
I see.
It just means that they're all kind of ready in there. But in particular on that Foles record, we had a mic called The Mic. And again, I still use that, which was, I think it was running through the Neve desk and then a Dynamite compressor. You know, the one that's got the sort of like little triangle and the lights go across. Do you know that? You can get some real suction happening. Right. Because we also had a PA in the room, it created this sort of amazing glue for the whole, all the songs. Inhaler,
yeah.
You know, that mic is like sort of really prominent. So it creates a bit of depth, plus a bit of movement, plus a bit of glue. So for every track, we'd adjust the compression to work with the tempo of the song, basically.
So that mic's not just picking up drums, it's picking up stuff coming out of the PA as well in during the take. Oh, sick. Okay.
Sometimes if I'm not using a PA, which I often don't use a PA, in fact, never used a PA since.
Sure.
But, you know, I'll open up all the guitar room doors so that mic will pick up something. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah.
But it's great on cymbals or toms, you know. I mean, I like that. Just really make them poke through if you get the compression sort of right.
I see.
But, again, it's another fun thing to kind of be really extreme with.
Yeah.
You're not just recording the sound. You're recording the sweat.
Yeah, I think I get it. Yeah.
Nice, I like that. Catherine, before we move on to some kind of, there's a few more questions about some mixing or producing, but just while we're in this sort of engineering thing, and I've never interviewed anyone that worked with him, but I understand you engineered a Kanye vocal session when you were starting out.
Yeah.
Can you talk to us about that? Just how was that as a feeling? And obviously he was pretty famous then, he's now infamous, but people forget what an incredible producer he was and that's how he built his career. What was it like watching someone like that work and be involved with helping facilitate them?
Well, so that was for a Mr. Hudson album, which was Straight No Chaser, and he had been heavily involved in the production of that early on, as had Dave McCracken. And we were just sort of in the sort of finishing touches stage and mixing stage, so we'd kind of taken over the whole of Battery. This is crazy, actually, this whole thing. And I can't remember if it was over one night or two, but basically he was due to come in at a certain time. It was Fashion Week. He didn't turn up, I think, till 2 a.m.
Wow.
I had 12 microphones set up and mic chains set up. I was so nervous.
Of course.
And basically the idea was we wanted him to sing on a couple of the tracks, but he seemed really disinterested to start with. So that was sort of... But then he was like, let me try something. He didn't try on... he tried on the song that we didn't want him to sing on anyway, and he went in and... I immediately knew which mic I wanted to use. Done. And he self-edits, so he comps as he goes. But he's a real genius. Or he was, at least at that time.
Mm.
I mean, just kind of freestyling and the rhymes that he came up with, you can't help but be blown away by that.
Mm. Sure.
And I remember he came back in and he's like, what do you think? And I said, would you be up for doing that again? And he said, no. And I said, well, in that case, it was perfect.
Amazing.
but he edited himself while he was in the booth, because he was like, can you take that word from take 12, the other one from like, well, you're 3 or whatever.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, I was not expecting that. But managed to kind of fluff my way through that. And there, I wish I could find this photo, but there's a photo of him standing over me. I'm wearing like a really dorky outfit. I wish I had cooler dress sense back then. And it looks like I'm telling him off because he's got his hand over his face, and I'm like looking quite stern at him. But it's lost in the ether somewhere. Yeah, but he was ace. I mean, he was great.
I wanted to ask about the St. Vincent record you worked on, Mass Seduction. Really big fan of that. I think it's just got great sound, and I read you spoke about it before and said she knew exactly what she wants. I find artists who know exactly what they want can be quite tough to work with sometimes, but it seems like that was a really enjoyable experience for you. Would you talk about that?
Well, because I love it when an artist knows what they want, because then I'm feeding off their energy and their ideas rather than I mean, I'm a producer because I don't have any ideas of my own. I'm trying to extrapolate the best out of what the artist I'm working with is doing, and then I'm inspired to like help kind of achieve whatever they're trying to achieve. So when I remember with Fear the Future, that was the first one I did. We were sort of talking about stuff. She was kind of giving me her idea of what it was sonically that she wanted to do. And I think I said, you know, what I hear is like Nine Inch Nails meets Kylie Minogue. And the ending Sick. Of that should feel like the underground rave scene in The Matrix. And she's like, yes.
Sick. Yeah.
Nice.
And then, you know, and then she'd come in and tweak like little things, but she knew exactly what we were trying to achieve. So,
yes, yeah. as long as the artist doesn't have this kind of unachievable vision of exactly what they want, then I guess it's okay. I guess I've run into that a few times, but yeah.
What's an example of an unachievable vision?
I don't know. Just like they want two things to happen at the same time that are completely incompatible, I've found.
I mean, for me, the unachievable would be I want a really big drum sound, but you're recording it in a 2 meter by 2 meter padded booth. I can't do that unless I do it artificially. That's
yes.
Yeah, I was about to say, I feel that what Bob's talking about is often drum things, and it's like, if that was just kicked through more and had much more space in the mix, but also the vocal was still the loudest thing while that was happening, and it's like there's only so many kilohertz that we can hear. And
Yeah,
it's usually kick and bass stuff. It's like, oh yeah, I love that bass line. Can we have another bass line doing this? And it's like, you want two bass lines. Yeah, things that are competing, basically. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, I mean, one of my favorite things is to be working with someone with this sort of seemingly impossible vision.
Yeah.
Because, and I'm talking more artistically than, you know, technically.
Yeah, sure.
You know, that to me is so kind of inspiring, because how do I achieve that? You know, that pushes me. Mm. Whereas if you're just talking about generic, you know, I want a guitar sound to sound like, I don't know,
yeah,
Stone Roses. I'm like,
yeah, yeah.
Mind you, I love the Stone Roses, and I'm like all about that. So,
sure.
You know, I'm sort of more interested in the kind of esoteric explanations of what someone wants.
Those visual explanations can be so good, because it's so hard to describe music and the sound in your head, and sometimes it's that shared cultural reference, like the end of The Matrix or something, that just gets you on the same page, and it's great.
For sure.
You worked on the latest Alanis Morissette record.
Yes.
Did you go out to, were you in America for that?
I did a lot of it here.
Okay.
On my own, kind of demoing the ideas. I got in Frank Turner, Chris from the Amazons, Mr. Hudson.
This is a super group, Catherine. This is unreal.
I know, but none of the, I mean, to basically come in and play some guitar or bass.
Sure.
Because I can't play guitar or bass, to kind of demo the ideas. But then went and I sort of programmed some drums or whatever. I had a piano and vocal to work with, and then we went out to LA and worked with her band, who are amazing.
Wow, yeah.
I'd play it to them and then they'd just nail it.
Oh, yeah.
And there was one song called Nemesis where because I didn't put it to a grid, I just tempo mapped the entire song. I think there's like a 19 BPM speed up in one bar.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
And they nailed it the first time.
That's ridiculous.
I know. I loved it. And they're so, they were so nice, and they sort of gave me this level of respect that I'd never experienced before as well. I guess being a producer in LA is very different to what it means to be a producer here.
So were they sort of trusting you to arrange around her ideas and bring those sort of...
Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah, sorry, this is a total curveball, but it relates. You're trained as a pianist, is that right? That was sort of your musical background.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't practiced for a long time, sure. So I haven't that discipline. I can play chords and make up some crap.
that's all you need.
Yeah. Do you think, I had this one question, which is a pretty geeky question, but do you think when you're learning the piano, it's such a tonally diverse instrument. Do you think that helps you when you're building a mix, that you've got that grounding of like, do you feel that your ears were sort of trained to that because you'd come up playing the piano, or did that all just come once you sort of got in a studio environment and sort of started understanding it in that way?
I think it came more from having experience in the studio, but also my architecture background, because I often think of the way that I build songs is like constructing something and the layers and the foundations. Yeah. I remember on the Wombats record, we wanted the album to sort of feel simple, but feel kind of really a little bit rough around the edges. So I was talking to him about the kind of engineering behind a lot of modernist architecture, where everything sort of seems sort of really pristine and clean and neat. And the complexity is behind, actually the process in making that record was quite complex, but what you get is something that feels very simple and straightforward. Mm-hmm. I like talking about music.
This brings me on to another question I was going to ask. I read that you like to visualize a mix. I wondered if you could elaborate on what that means for you.
Oh, this is perfect actually, because I'm in the middle of mixing an album for an amazing artist. And so when I'm literally sitting here, I close my eyes and I'm visualizing an image that I want to create, or I'm literally visualizing where everything sits. A mix can feel really good two-dimensionally, but how do you make it feel three-dimensional,
yeah,
basically? And a lot of it's through trial and error. Eventually I can sort of get it to where this is totally subjective, but whereas I feel like I have a sense that this thing is surrounding me, and I can visualize where all the detail is within that. I guess it's like a sphere around my head. That's how I see it, and where are all those things sitting.
So
struggling to do that at the moment, though.
Okay. You can reconnect to it in this interview and then take it back.
I know.
Shakespeare once said that music is the food of love. But what is the food of music? As much as the right microphone or guitar amp, what we eat or drink can be such a crucial part of a recording session. So each week we like to ask our guests, what do they cook or order to get the mood right in the studio?
Funny you should ask this. This is back in 2005, I think, end of 2005. I went and assisted on Ben Hillier and a Future Head session.
Yeah.
Up in Scarborough, then made a studio in the middle of nowhere on this amazing sort of property and converted all the barns into various different studios. And they had been looking for both a chef and an assistant. And as soon as I'd heard this, must have been months before the session, I was like, pick me. Anyway, they couldn't find anyone who could do all the time. So the day before they were due to take the train up, they were like, "Ugh, okay, can you cook?" And I was like, some. So I ended up being the assistant and the cook for that entire session. And there was a massive big arg, and I just rang my mum and I was like, what do I do to cook for like eight people? So mum would give me like amazing recipes, like lasagnas or this yummy casserole, the chicken casserole, which involved, I haven't cooked it since, but I remember it's in such clear detail. So bit of bacon, bit of onion, and then you brown each side of the chicken breast. So you put that one layer, then you put a layer of like carrots and zucchini, and then you brown some more chicken, another in the bacon and an onion, put another layer on, then another layer of vegetables, and repeat, and then a whole lot of vegetable stock.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Pour that into like a baking dish or, you know, casserole dish, mm-hmm. put the lid on. And I remember the casserole dish was clear, so I was able to see like how nicely everything
was done. Yeah.
And you stick it in the aga for 40 minutes or whatever, whack some big potatoes in the other part of the aga, so you've got like yummy, crispy baked potatoes. Mm. And then pull it all out, and it was fucking delicious. Because the stock reduces, everything's like filled with yummy flavor, and then you just sort of like put all the rest of the juices over the baked potato.
Sounds delicious.
I became an amazing cook after that. I was like freestyling everything.
Amazing. I don't think we've ever got a full recipe before in response to that question.
So we got a really good rice cooking technique.
Oh, yeah.
Also, aga cooking, that is like life goals. That's like aga's rock.
I know. It was so, also what happened, I remember, because I would have to like prepare the lunch and the dinner and then sort of run back and like, you know, move a microphone or whatever. I remember I happened to be in the kitchen one lunchtime and we had an answering machine. And I let it ring, and a woman said, yes, hello, this is Kate Bush for Future Heads.
What?
I wanted to say that I really liked Hounds of Love, and I'm like just standing there with like potatoes in my hands going, oh!
What an amazing moment. That's nice awesome. To know that she was into that cover. That's great.
Yeah, it was such a good cover. I love that cover.
Yeah, you love
that. Yeah, I love that whole record. That's good. Yeah. So the first one is, what's your favourite studio you've ever worked in?
ICP Studios in Belgium.
Oh, right. Is that where you work with Wolf Alice?
Yeah.
I did one session at ICP and I just couldn't believe it.
I've done a couple of things over there. I love it.
Your favourite plugin?
I'm going to have to say, this is really hard. I have like 10.
Okay.
I'm just gonna be unexpected and say the Bond Factory 1176.
Oh, cool.
Nice.
Why that one over various other 1176 plugins, which other people have mentioned as their faves?
One, because I feel proud that I finally understand what the attack and release do on it. It's taken me years.
Right.
And also I actually tend to use it all over my mixes, and it's not in the ways that you would think. So it's not it's for, I usually always add it to like reverbs and delays, either to like sidechain them or to push them back behind the vocals or particular instruments. Because if you, so Ben Baptie actually taught me this thing. So say with say you've got like a really long decay on a reverb, you put the Bomb Factory plugin on, you put the attack and the release all the way to both to the right.
Okay.
Turn down the output, turn up the input quite hard, and then just gradually turn up the output, and you'll see that what it does is, or the intention is, that it pushes the vocal forward. So rather than drowning, so you've got, this is as a send, not as like an effect over that track.
Yeah.
It won't feel like the vocal is drenched in reverb, but you'll get the sense of the tail after the vocal. And it just, to me, it just pushes the vocal, seems to push the vocal forward.
That's really cool. You're going to try it. So what about your favorite piece of hardware?
This guy. I think I'm soon. It's an Echo Sex.
Nice.
Catherine's holding it up to the Zoom call at the moment, and yeah, looks very saucy.
It's really nice. It's Valve, and I love twiddling knobs.
I've never messed with it. Is it called an Echo Sex because it's kind of riffing on an Echo Plex?
On an Echo Rec.
Echo Rec. Oh right.
Yeah. I think it's modelled on that.
Do you have a favourite synth, Catherine?
Juno 106.
Straight away.
So simple.
Finally, what's your favourite microphone?
SM7.
Oh, nice.
It's had a lot more. If we were to put money down when we started this podcast, I don't think we'd have put SM7 near the top. But it's had a lot of love, and it's great because it's fairly accessible for people.
Yeah. Well, the SM7Bs, yeah. I mean, that's what I've got. I like it because you can hold it in your hands. You can press up against it. You're not separated by sort of a pop shield. But also you record everything with it. Guitars, sounds great on acoustic guitars, piano, mono, you know, drums.
What's the most important tool at your disposal as a producer?
I think, yeah, being able to work with other people. But also sort of being able to read situations.
Yeah.
I think that's where the sensitivity aspect comes in, and sort of understanding what is required in particular situations. I'm very good at reading people, knowing when they're unhappy and or when they're, you know, feeling good about something.
I thought it was interesting listening to you talk about working with a big moon. You said it was funny because it was the first time you'd had to produce an all-female band and you'd sort of, for want of a better phrase, figured out how to deal with dudes in bands, like having been a dude in a band. And every album I sadly made was just an absolute dude fest. And I thought that was a really interesting idea. Like, I know how to, four guys playing guitars, I know how to like get them in the right space, but working with four women is different. Like, have you sort of, as hopefully the music industry becomes more diverse, do you find yourself using different tools or having different emotional spaces for that sensitivity and patience?
I mean, obviously, like working with the Big Moon was an absolute riot. We had it was hands down one of the best experiences I've had in the studio. We had so much fun and we laughed a lot. So while I was sort of initially nervous, I think. I found working with other women just so joyous because there is a different energy. But sometimes I can feel intimidated by them where I'm just not intimidated by the dudes.
I think that's a great place to finish. Yeah. Thank you so much, Catherine. That was really great.
Lawrence, the thing I think most impressed me about Catherine was that she, when she's engineering, she's really like getting the sounds right at source. She's not one of these engineers that's just going to rely on fixing it in the mix later. You know, she talked about that one project where she didn't even touch the drum stems at the mix stage, and I just think that's really impressive. And I mean, that is top level engineering, and I think there was many examples of that in the interview, but. She just really impressed me on that front.
Yeah, definitely. And that made me sort of realize she talked about that thing of like when she first met Flood and saying, he said to her, go and live a bit because once you start on this path, like it's going to be 18-hour, 20-hour days for 10 years. And weirdly, she's one of the first emerging producers or new producers that we've spoken to where they've had that career path. Yeah. Where they start as the T person and then they become maybe not the tape op, but like the junior engineer and then the senior engineer, and then they start producing. And she spent all that time in Assault and Battery learning and gathering all this knowledge about how to make records sound incredible.
Yeah.
And even begun thinking she might go on a mixer's path rather than a producer's path. And all of that is feeding into what you're talking about there, which is just like making things sound amazing at source.
Yeah.
And doing all the heavy lifting there, and that I really like that idea of making a record that way.
I think it's brilliant. I think it's a really good path, and really sets you up well to be such a top professional. That path of coming through from assisting someone, and we talk about it being a bit of an old fashioned path, but and obviously there aren't as many studios around as there used to be, but they do still exist. And I think that studio decline has hopefully kind of plateaued now, and there's less than there were in the 80s, 90s, but there's still room to go and do that and assist people and learn. And I still think it's a great path. And Catherine's a great example of how, you know, obviously it was a bit random how she ended up meeting Flood, but like Flood obviously saw something in her, and like she wouldn't have stuck around if she wasn't talented and the right and probably like the right kind of personality for that sort of role as well.
Yeah, definitely. She's clearly got that can-do personality and just a commitment and a work ethic. And that came out. There were some more stories actually around the engineering of that Kanye West session, where across that whole Mr. Hudson album, there was a lot of guest vocalists and rappers coming in, and she just basically said she was just up for like 3 weeks because they would come in at 4 a.m.
Yeah,
and she just had to be ready to go with the mic chains and stuff. I mean,
yeah,
exciting times. And you know, me and you are big fans of that period of Kanye, And it was lovely to hear that. And it is a shame where things have gone, because you do hear from people that have worked from him that when he's creating music, particularly during that time, he was just so committed to the music. And you really got that from Catherine's story about her. I mean, this interview is about Catherine and there's so much more to unpack, but it's always amazing to hear about those superstars and how they work.
Yeah, nice to get a little insight on him. He is a bit of a savant, isn't he? And like, you know, one of a kind. And yes, he may well have gone insane, but no. I think, yeah, that's because there's something totally unique about the way his mind works, clearly.
It was also great, which kind of we touched on in the interview, but I know it's obviously it's an audio medium, but Catherine was giving us this interview from her new studio space.
Yeah.
And it was really interesting that even though she's got this incredible knowledge of how to make a record sound, inverted commas, correct, she was really excited to talk about how she's going to explore that space and actually kind of get those rough edges in of where she's recording. One of your favorite stories sort of related to that was when she was doing that Foles record and they recorded the PA coming back into the mic.
I like what she said about recording the sweat, you know. Like I those Foles records sound massive. Obviously they started as this quite intricate
math rocky kind
this kind of complex sounding rock band, but they evolved into this kind of expansive rock behemoth, and
we are on the vocab for our first episode back, and I'm
on the vocab for the gigantic things. Yeah.
Yes.
And yeah, I don't know. You sort of think about those kind of albums as being produced maybe in a bit of a sterile way, but on the Foles records, you can hear this big, tangible, living thing, and I think that comes from letting there be a bit of bleed between the instruments and stuff, and I think it's a really cool kind of brave way to record, and it must be quite tricky, but you know,
that's
great.
My favorite thing about Catherine's records, and there's someone else we're going to interview in this. Well, there's two other people we're going to interview in this run, Burke Reed, who produces people like Sports Team, DZ Death Rays, and Luke Smith, who actually produced Total Life Forever, the second Foles record. And what I find really interesting about these producers and what I really enjoy about their music, and I suppose for Catherine, it probably comes from Flood and Alan, and that it's very much their, Alan Moulder, very much their work thing of producing big, for want of a better word, like radio straddling epic rock records that like join the canon, but doing it in such an interesting way, and allowing music creation to be that fun kind of getting your fingers messy thing, and not a thing like you're saying, like a sterile thing where it's like, we're aiming top 10 here, guys, this is how you would record a top 10 record. And Catherine is clearly doing that with the work she does with people like Big Moon and even Alanis and stuff like that.
I think Foles are really interesting because they've got to that place at kind of the in the top echelons of like the UK rock music by being one of the most interesting and innovative bands in terms of who they work with, the techniques they embrace. You know when our Luke Smith episode comes out, you know, he'll be the third person we've spoken to that's been heavily involved in a Foles record, and I think the fact that all of these top people are coming up and they've been involved in these projects and all the music's really interesting, I think it just speaks volumes about that band and how adventurous they are, and
it's not a coincidence that these people work with that band. No, exactly. Definitely. And they've really evolved and just so listenable, but also so interesting. And I think that's a good way of describing Catherine's work as well. Yeah. Like, you can listen to these records and just be like, these records kick. But then, you know, having heard her talk about it and knowing her background and her understanding, you can just dig deeper and get into the sonics and the sweat on the record.
Exactly.
It's not the sweat on the tape anymore, unfortunately, but it sort of feels that way, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, there might be some tape involved at somewhere in the process.
Yeah, and, you know, almost certainly.
Yeah, part of the sound. The one other little nugget I loved was she was talking about when she was cranking the EQ on the snare or something, and like, I'm just loving adding 12 dB in it. And I was mentioning the DFA button. I don't know if we've talked about that before on the podcast, but like some producer, maybe even it was us talking about it years ago, but the DFA button is a real thing when like you think you're doing something. Oh, DFA stands for does F all, by the way.
Yes.
Either by accident you might be like doing something thinking like, this is making the sound better, and you actually find it's doing nothing. Or when you know, I don't necessarily do this, but when a client's going like, oh, can you just make that louder, or can you make that a bit brighter, or whatever, and you go, yeah, and you just start doing something, and you're not actually doing anything like, yeah, yeah, that's great, that's it, and it's just like, it might be a little technique that you pull out the bag when someone's asking for something that maybe is ill-advised.
I found it reassuring that someone as in command of their craft as Catherine occasionally does do that, make that error, because it's certainly something I've done. I've A-B'd two sources and then suddenly realised I'm A-B'ing the same source, like literally a duplicate.
The mind plays tricks on us all.
It does indeed. It was a pleasure to interview Catherine. As I say, we wanted to interview her as our first run of interviews back in 2021, but she is incredibly busy and she very kindly found time for that interview. So thank you to her. Thank you to all of you for being back with us.
Yep.
It's exciting to be back.
It's great to be back. Please keep sharing and keep getting in contact with us. We love interacting with you guys and hearing your feedback. It's been really nice getting to know a couple of you over email. So get in touch with us at processofproductionpodcast@gmail.com or on the Instagram, which is @processofproduction. So share it, hit us up, and
we'll see you in a fortnight's time.
Yeah. Can't wait for the next one.
Have a good one, guys.
Bye.